This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello and welcome. This is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Don't worry, his bark is worse than his bite. Not really. His bite is much worse than his bark. This episode is in recognition of the Halloween season, which is upon us as we speak. And we are going to take a little visit to the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado. This is near the beautiful gateway that goes into the park and was built back in 1909 and has quite an interesting history. It was built by the Stanley family as being a place of respite and kind of a spa for people to recover from tuberculosis at the time. And Mr. Stanley invited many of his millionaire friends to come out to visit and to recuperate and enjoy the summer vacation in his lodge that he had built. Down through the years, it's had very interesting history, which is worth looking up, and I recommend that you go to Google and check that out. But as we walk down the hallway here, one of the most interesting things about the Stanley Hotel is why it even exists today. It seems that back in 1974, that it had a solitary family as guests overnight, just before they were preparing to close for the winter. For you see, even up through that time, they still had no central heating. It wasn't until the early 80s that they finally put heat in the hotel. So therefore, they closed up the hotel for the winter. Well, the family was a little bit freaked out, just being the only ones there. And during the night, the father had a nightmare. His nightmare was that his son was being chased by a fire hose down one of the hallways. Well, before that he had checked out of the hotel with his wife and son, he had enough of a germ of an idea to write a book, which was later turned into a movie. And of course that person was Stephen King, and the movie was called The Shining. And it was a direct result of the success of that book and the movie that saved the hotel from probably being demolished and going into bankruptcy. Now, the movie was not filmed here in the Stanley Hotel. As we look around, there are a lot of artifacts, of course, that would indicate perhaps to the contrary, but as you will see, that this looks really nothing like the actual set design that they used on the film of The Shining. Much of that was filmed, again, in a place in Oregon, and the hedge maze was not added until many years later, as it was not part of the original hotel when Stephen King had visited. Well, today we're going to be visiting with a magician, a bizarre magician, Aidan Sinclair. And Aidan is someone who presents seances in a very strange place, not just at the Stanley Hotel, but also aboard the Queen Mary and at the Winchester House. Wherever there might be spooks, I think there you'll find Aidan. He has a very interesting story to tell, and I'm going to let him tell it. So please welcome my friend this week, Mr. Aidan Sinclair, here on The Magic Word. Today I have with me a guest who is pretty much on the spooky side, someone that I was introduced to by a friend of mine and of yours, Jessica Jane Peterson. Jessica was, or JJ, as I like to call her, was a guest of ours on an episode of the Magic Word Podcast some time ago and is just a delightful young lady. And I saw on Instagram that she and David Minkin were at the Stanley Hotel filling in for our guest a while back here in, which is in Colorado. And of course, the Stanley Hotel is best known for The Shining, Stephen King's movie starring Jack Nicholson. And so that kind of led to her introducing me then to Aiden and then me contacting him. And one thing kind of led to another. And I figured that we have a lot of overlap and things certainly in common, and talking about seances and the paranormal and speaking to the dead, plus other kinds of things. And the more that I'd gotten into it, that, well, this is going to be just delightful. There are a lot of things we're going to be getting into with my guest. Please welcome him today, Mr. Aiden Sinclair. Hi, Aiden. How are you?
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for joining me. I was very excited whenever I heard about this, because typically I think of these shows about the spooky side or the bizarre side or being more in the Halloween spirit. But here we are actually recording this conversation here in late August, early September. And this is something that you have been doing, I guess, since July there at the Stanley Hotel. First of all, tell me, what is the program that you're doing? It's called Illusion of the Past, PASSED.
Correct. That is our show. It's been a resident show at the Stanley Hotel for the past almost 7 years now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we opened up there about 7 years ago. And because of the nature of the venue, it just is it's a historic hotel that has a certain haunted history. And added to that haunted history, of course, is the legacy that Stephen King adds to it. He had stayed in the hotel in the 1970s, and that stay inspired him to write The Shining. So it's, for spooky stuff, it's a great venue. And once we opened there, other venues kind of reached out to us, and the show's been pretty successful for that period. So over the years, we've extended that show, and we present it in different fashions and different forms mm-hmm. at historically haunted locations around the United States. So we perform regularly at the Stanley, as well as the Queen Mary and the Winchester Mystery House in California. And we take the show on the road every once in a while to places like the Lizzie Borden House and wow. the Belleville Winery. And if it's spooky and weird, we've probably been there for a little bit of time. So it's a lot of fun.
That is phenomenal. Yeah, I want to get into all that, but I want to go also then, speaking of the past, going back into some of the history, because you were on America's Got Talent back in 2015 and had progressed and for a little ways. And I think, did Piff beat you out? I think there was another magician. Piff, is that his year?
Piff was on that year, and I did two rounds with him, and mm-hmm. Had two standing ovations from him. It went great, and I had an interesting experience with the executive producers at the end of that, and I was in a very different place in my life, and I had the opportunity to decide whether I wanted to continue or not with the show, and at that time, it was better for me not to. It just...
Can you share the experience or what it was you had with the producer, or was that something that contractually you can't discuss?
There's some things we can talk about it. The show is an amazing platform. Mm-hmm. But of course, most people, especially in magic, that audition for America's Got Talent, all they know is what they see on television. Mm-hmm. And they expect that that's going to be the experience, that you go to this big cattle call audition. And, you know, if they like you, you advance. And unless you've had a lot of experience in the television industry, it can be very difficult. It can be very trying. And it can be hard for a lot of people to adapt to the reality of performing for television, vice performing for a live audience. And it's hard. Mm-hmm. The experience that I had was that a few years before, I had just left prison. And
Federal penitentiary?
Correct. Mm-hmm. I got into a lot of trouble in my life and was not a really great human for a great period of it. I lived in the world of con and grift and operated very illegal poker rooms. And that was my life. And at a certain point in my life, I had an epiphany that that's not really who you have to be. And that though I'd done a lot of things wrong in my life, I had control of it and I could either continue to live that life or not. So in 2005, I kind of walked into the U.S. Marshal's office and sat down and said, "Hi, you guys have been looking for me for about 15 years, and here's everything illegal I've ever done, and I'm retired. I'm done."
Wow.
So I turned myself into the authorities. I ended up serving 5 years. And during that time, I really just got up every morning, poured my coffee, grabbed a deck of cards, grabbed my book of Ordinaries, and went to work. And just did magic 12 hours a day, every day. Anything I could read, anything I could practice, that's what I was drawn to.
And did you perform for some of the other inmates there as well? And were they jealous or want to break your fingers? Or
No. It was an amazing experience for a couple of reasons. Is that prison is probably the most segregated environment that you can exist in America today, in the sense that it is self-segregated. You know, the prison as a whole doesn't really care about race or culture or religious belief.
Interesting.
But in a compound of 1,400 to 1,700 men, you have every culture you can imagine. And because of those cultural differences, people self-segregate by race, by religious belief. But by doing magic, I was probably the only person in the compound that could truly interact with every culture. I could move from group to group. It would be very rare that I'd walk across a compound that somebody wouldn't say, "Hey, can you show me a trick?" And to be truthful, it took going to prison to really truly learn what magic was, because it's very easy to get caught up into the technique and the mechanics and the trickery of it, you know, that the I fooled you moment of it. And magic is so much more than that. It has the potential to be so much more than that. And while I was there, I was invited over to do some sleight of hand for an outlaw biker. And this was a guy who was serving time for probably 20 years of his life. I always kind of describe him as looking like Odin. You know, he was just this massive bodybuilding guy who was in his very late 60s, but could physically destroy anybody that stood in front of him. You know, he just had this build like Thor. And he stood there, and some people, when you perform magic for them, you know, they see it as a challenge or a puzzle to be solved. And if you perform long enough, you're going to run across somebody who just doesn't like magic. They don't like being put into that position.
Right.
And it feels confrontational, you know, to them of, you know, that they're being made fun of or challenged in some way. Mm-hmm. So I go over to this guy, and he's surrounded by all these kind of Hells Angels and outlaws and, you know, these hardcore bikers. And I know this guy is doing time for murder and that he's a dangerous, dangerous guy.
Wow.
And respect is a very big deal. Mm-hmm. So as I'm performing for him, he's wearing these wraparound sunglasses, and he doesn't emote. He doesn't, you know, jokes that would get a little laugh by everybody. Mm-hmm. Nothing. He was just deadpan the whole time. And about 5 minutes in, I'm starting to worry if he's feeling disrespected, because if he's feeling like I'm making fun of him, the consequences could be pretty brutal.
Yeah, you know, making a fool of him instead of fooling him.
Exactly. And not only that, but in front of all of his men, you know, all of his clique. Right. So no matter what I do, nothing seems to get a reaction from him. And I notice that he has this laundry bag and it's full of oranges. And earlier that day, I decided that I wanted to perform Card for Orange that day. So I've got this orange all prepped up, and I'm just waiting for the opportunity, you know, sometime during the day to do it. But they have very strict rules in prison. Like, you can take one piece of fruit out of the chow hall. And here's this guy that's got a bag full of fruit, you know, because other people have given him their oranges.
Sure.
So I see the bag, and I said, are those your oranges? And the first thing that he's ever said to me so far, he goes, "Is that really any of your business?"
Okay.
And I was like, well, I was just asking because I wanted to see if I could borrow one. Because what he hadn't realized was, when I walked up and I saw the bag, I was like, this is the moment. This is the perfect time. Mm-hmm. So I'd managed to get my orange into his bag. So now I just need to figure out, how am I going to get him to pick my orange? You know, and it's slightly marked so I can identify it. And I had one of these burglarious moments. So I said, "I'd love to use one of your oranges for this last thing, if you'd be willing." And he goes, he just kind of nods. And I said, "Grab an orange." And he just happened to grab the one, you know. So it was perfect. It was a perfect magic moment of, in his mind, he had been carrying these oranges all day. He never saw me touch them, so he had no way of knowing, you know, that anything facetious had happened.
Right.
So I have him pick a card, and the card is destroyed, of course. And I tell him I'm going to reassemble it into one piece. And I just reproduce the corner. And I go, "Look, one piece." And nothing, you know, he's just deadpan.
Right.
and I ask him to open up the orange. So he opens up the orange, and of course, there's the reveal, and there's the card, and all these guys start laughing, and they're like, oh my God, that was amazing. And this guy holds up his hand, you know, like he's a king. Mm-hmm. And immediately everybody gets quiet.
Ooh, boy.
And then he just waves his hand and everybody just leaves. So I start to step away and he goes, not you. And I'm worried,
yeah.
You know, and he waits until everybody is gone. And when everyone was gone, that was the first time he took his sunglasses off. And when he took off his sunglasses, his eyes were full of tears. And he looked me in the eye and he said, brother, that's the first time in 20 years I forgot that I was in prison. Thank you.
Wow.
And he gave me a big hug. And I was just overwhelmed by that moment. But the moment taught me that that's what magic is supposed to be. It should take people away from reality. And here's this guy surrounded by guard towers and, you know, the most awful things that you can imagine, a world completely immersed in violence and, you know, discipline. And for this period of time, it didn't matter that he was this big, tough killer. He was a 5-year-old experiencing magic, you know, in his heart. And I think a lot of people that perform magic sometimes forget that. They forget the potential that an effect can provide for somebody. And it's sometimes, you know, an important thing to remember, I think.
Yeah, that is an amazing story and quite a testimony there then, too. I'm curious, as far as in 2005 when you walked into the office to give yourself up, what was the epiphany that led to that, if you could share that you decided, I've had enough of this life, I want to move forward, pay for my crimes?
I think it's this is going to sound probably sexist in that I think in every man's life, the thing that drives most, and not even men, honestly, I think anybody is driven by the motivation of love. You know, when you, mm-hmm. when you find love in your life, no matter what it is, then it can shape you, it can define you, it can change you. And I'd lived most of my life in a world of deception and deceit and not for entertainment. And, I finally had met somebody that, I didn't want to be that person with. And the only way to, you know, tell somebody at that point, I knew I loved this girl. And how can I tell her that in honesty? Yet she doesn't even know my real name. You know, she knows nothing about me.
Wow.
So that was the moment for me, was to kind of, I thought about a lot of things. I thought about what happens if I married this woman. And at the time I had really good identity documents. And I could have gotten married and had children and a family, and nobody would have known who I was. But I knew.
Right.
And it started weighing on me. There was a bit of it. And there was also a bit of, what if I have children? And how do I tell a son or a daughter someday to tell the truth and to be good and to be noble and to have integrity and honor? And I'm not. You know, I couldn't reconcile those two things. And I also remembered a time that I had served in the Marines, and I believed in honor and integrity.
Sure.
And part of the things that drove me in criminal activity for a long time was that once I did one thing illegal, I let it define me. I was like, well, I'm just a bad person, and that's all I'm ever going to be. So it really doesn't matter what I do. And that's a huge excuse and cop out. It's a real easy way to not take responsibility for things. When I got older and a little wiser, the epiphany was that you do make mistakes in life, but you also have the ability to reconcile them. You have the ability to own them.
Mm-hmm.
And I take great pride in the fact that nobody kicked down my door and dragged me out of my bed, kicking and screaming and put me in handcuffs, that I took the responsibility of walking in and going, hey, I'm done. These things were wrong.
And that would have been a horrible thing, certainly, had you married and had children, for your family
God,
to have witnessed if that was the case, too. So, yeah, it's a good thing to kind of go leave that behind. And was she waiting for you at the end of the 5 years?
No, not a thing that really happens. I think that happens in the movies.
In the movies, that's why.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But I truly do believe you meet people in life that, you know, teach you. Everyone you meet teaches you a lesson and has a purpose in your life. And I think that was the thing to come out of that with her, was that it showed me, you know, who I was very clearly, mm-hmm. who I wanted to be. And it also, you know, kind of gave me the strength to be better. And I still, you know, try to be better. You know, it's
that's great.
It's hard because there's a lot in my past that I'm still trying to make good for and make up on. And it's a daily grind to try to do it.
What an inspirational story. Are those things that you talk about to groups? Do you go into schools and talk with kids about that or other places?
I do. Mm-hmm. I do. We work a lot with I go in with at-risk youth schools. There's a lot of schools around the country that are they're kind of last chance high schools. In Cheyenne, Wyoming, there's one I go to quite a bit that is the kids that are at this school have pretty much been expelled from other schools. All of the children there have some form of problem. You know, they've interacted with the law. Mm-hmm. Most of the young girls that are there are single mothers already. And truthfully, they have endured and faced challenges that are harder and more complicated than many adults I know, you know, and they're in their teenage years. And a lot of these kids feel like those mistakes will define their entire life, that they're so screwed up that they're done and they're 16. Mm-hmm. So their teachers tell them every day they're not and that they have all these chances. And I truly don't believe I tell them anything different than what their teachers tell them.
You just reinforce that.
It does. And it comes from a matter of perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, they see a guy that walks in the door, you know, with tattoos and has done time, yet I have a successful business and we make good money and, you know, we own our mistakes and we move forward with them. And I think some kids will see that and go, you know, okay, this guy screwed up and he's doing okay. So maybe it's not too late for me. Mm-hmm. And truthfully, at that age, it's not, you know, they have so much potential.
Yes.
And it's both heartbreaking to see a 16-year-old kid feel like his future is impossible and that he has no choices or she has no choices and that nothing good will ever come to them.
Do you tie in magic at all with those discussions?
I often will. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the one time that I generally don't do spooky stuff. It's because it's a presentation that's really based about deception and perception. And that's a little bit better demonstrated through just things like Three Card Monty and the cups and balls and the classics of magic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You can connect in that way. It's actually the most rewarding thing that I've ever had probably happen in the last 10 years was the first day that I had ever done this, the first school I went to, I did my thing, and at the end of every lecture that I give at a school like that, I always leave like my Instagram and my Facebook stuff. And I always tell these kids, look, if you don't feel like you have anybody that you can talk to, send me a message at the very least before you feel like your life is over and you need to give up or you want to drop out of school. Just send me a message. And if I don't respond to it immediately, it's because I'm on a plane or I'm on a stage, but I will get back to you. And I respond to every single one as quickly as I can. And the first message I ever got was from a kid that just simply sent me a couple of lines that said, Mr. Sinclair, before I saw you today, I was going to quit school tomorrow. But after hearing you speak, I've decided to give it one more chance. I'm going to go tomorrow. No promises. And that was it. And I said, well, I'm here if you want to talk. And I'm glad you're going back tomorrow and try to find the one thing that gets you through the day that makes it good. And I heard nothing from the kid for 6 months. And then I just got this random message one day that said, Mr. Sinclair, just wanted to let you know I graduated today.
What a great story.
And I'll be honest with you. I like to think of myself as a tough guy sometimes, but I was done. You know, like I sat in my car and just started crying over it because it was just
like that big biker guy you had.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's mm-hmm. It is the impact that you can have on the world in a positive way that, you know, there's every art, I think, does it. You know, you can see a painting that brings you to tears or you can hear great music that causes you memory and emotion. It's disappointing to me that many magicians forget that they can do so much with this, you know, art. And to go, I fooled you is the easiest thing.
Sure.
You know, it's why I like the spooky stuff because it just – it allows a performance piece of magic to be more theatrical and also become something that people connect with.
So was that a direction that you went into after you got out then, I guess, what, in 2010?
Yeah, I got out of prison in 2011, and I was very fortunate in that I was a skilled bartender, and I knew how to make drinks, and I was good with talking to people. So I ended up in Cheyenne, Wyoming, which is an interesting town. It's an Air Force town and a railroad town and a gas and oil town, and it's a very much a cowboy place. Mm-hmm. But you'll meet some of the kindest people in the world there. You know, if you're stuck on the side of the road, four guys in a pickup truck will pull up and help you. You know, it's not things that you see in New York City or L.A., you
right.
know. Or, but
you got Southern hospitality up in the north there. The north
you
place.
Really do. Mm-hmm. You really do. And there's this weird kind of cowboy code there, you know, of, you know, men still take their hats off for ladies and open doors.
Open doors.
And, mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's
and yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a part of culture that I, sure. I think should have never gone away, but that's just my opinion. But I started bartending, and of course, bartending gives you the opportunity to do magic. And I started off doing that, and I was happy as can be. You know, it wasn't great money, but it was fun. And one of my regular customers at the bar one night asked me if I would do any private bookings outside of the bar. And this young lady happened to run the local safe house for domestic violence. So immediately I was like, absolutely, I'd love to do anything I can to help you guys. And she invited me to do a celebrity bartender thing. Basically, they're going to have this event to raise money for the safe house. And they wanted me to just bartend and do card tricks all night. And mm-hmm. I was enamored. I was like, sure, I'll do it. And then I went home and I started thinking about it. And the more I thought about it, the more it hit me that magic takes people away from reality. And they were really trying to raise awareness to domestic violence, which is something people don't want to talk about as it is. Mm-hmm. And I felt like doing card tricks and fooling people and making people laugh at an event where they should be kind of more focused on some pretty horrible stuff just didn't sit well with me. So I called her the next day and said, you know what, it just doesn't feel right to do what you were thinking, but what I would like to do is just do a full stage show that is about domestic violence, and that way it is raising awareness. Mm-hmm. And whatever money we make, we'll just give you to the safe house. So at that time, I had just read about an effect that had been put out by Vic Nadada at Gemini Artifacts. And Vic does some really incredible, bizarre work. I mean, if anytime somebody asks me about bizarre props, Gemini Artifacts is kind of where I direct people because it's the quality is good. The customer service is amazing. And he had created a book test called Luna. And the book test was these nurses' notebooks from a mental institution. And
I'm familiar with Luna. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an amazing piece.
I thought that was an outlaw effect.
Vic created it for Outlaw initially.
Yeah.
You know, if you're familiar with Outlaw, then you also know that there's been some chaos there.
Yes.
And a lot of shenanigans and shady dealings. And it took Vic quite a long time just to get the rights back to his own property, which is appalling.
Wow.
And when I first started in Bazaar, Outlaw was, you know, it seemed like a really nice place. They had all these great
things. It was kind of a go-to thing. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I learned very early on that you know, there was this shell game of money and people weren't getting their orders, and it got really shady really fast. So and it's disheartening that there are still people that have paid for props and products from them and have never seen them, you know, and they never will. They're gone.
Wow.
And the guy is now completely off the grid and, you know, not responding to any kind of contact, which is, you know, as a business, is you can't do that.
That's sad. Well, I didn't mean to get you off track. You were talking about Luna. And so,
Luna had just come out, and it kind of just, you know, it was one of those synchronicities of life or, you know, coincidences where the day that I'd learned about Luna, I was watching a BBC documentary called Mental online. And it's this documentary about the asylums in the United Kingdom and the history of asylums. And in that, they talked about Colney Hatch, the asylum that Luna is based off of. And as I was reading this and, you know, kind of watching this video, it hit me that one of the little blurbs they had mentioned was that Colney Hatch had had 3,000 patients at a time. And during that time, it was 75% of the patients were female. And that today we know that 90% of those women had no mental illness whatsoever, that they were just women that were committed by their husbands because it was easier to have them locked up than it was to get a divorce, which is nuts.
Wow.
So to me, that ability to take a wife and lock her away is its own horrible form of domestic violence.
A legal way back then, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. All you needed was one doctor and a witness to, you know, basically testify that your wife was hysterical.
It's kind of like a witch trial in a way, I guess, expanded to the general population, whereas the witch trials were just about a few people here that anybody could have their wife locked up or someone.
You could. And it was usually cheaper than to get a divorce attorney, you know, and easier, you know. So there were even physicians that specialized in it, you know, and then you start doing research on the institution Colney Hatch, and it's just got some crazy, weird, iconic history there. There's some Jack the Ripper history there. There's some Aleister Crowley history there. It's just like a rabbit hole that you just fall down.
Right.
So I thought that would be a really good basis for a show. And I wrote a show that was called From a Padded Room. And the show was really the story of women being institutionalized in this place. And in truth, there was only one magic effect in the entire show. Two, if you counted Luna, you know, we use Luna to allow a spectator to kind of connect with the asylum. And obviously we could reveal information about whatever they would feel like they randomly chose a patient out of this book. But of course we were able to reveal all this information about that patient. And we tried to do that in an original way. Instead of, you know, having somebody look into a book, we would never reveal the information that was actually in the book. We would use things that connect to it. Like, you know, many mentalists would have you focus on the date if there was a date.
Right.
And then they would reveal the numbers of the date. And that feels like a trick when you do that.
Or the room number or something.
Yeah. What I did very early on was kind of adapt visualization, because when you're doing mentalism, you're in essence working with one person on stage. And when we did this show, we had a 300-seat theater. So how do you make this one effect have an impact on all the other 300 people? And the easiest way to do it is to ask the person that you're working with to truly visualize, and then you can verbally paint these very broad pictures that are very visual. And even though you're working with one person, everybody in the audience is going to the same place. They imagine the same things. So, you know, we would force a patient that was interned during the winter, and we would paint this broad picture. And the spectator that you're working with knows the date. They know that November is kind of cold, and you've painted this picture of a dreary, drab England. And then instead of saying it's winter or it's November, I would ask the spectator to take a breath. And I would inhale like I was taking a breath at the same time. And then I would look at the spectator in the eyes and say, did you just taste peppermint? You know, because you think of cold air hitting the back of your throat. And, you know, you have that experience of winter, of what does winter taste like and feel like? And what does a cold breath of air feel like when it comes in? So and then I would look at the person and say, she's very cold. And you would get this really powerful reaction because you've not revealed a date. You haven't given them the specific thing, but you've given them a feeling.
Which is even better because, again, that you can reach the furthest person in the back of the auditorium because they're getting the same feeling. Because even though they can't see something, which is an advantage, I mean, if you're trying to do like a card trick and you're holding up a card, people can't see too far beyond the second or third row. But if you're doing something, again, that's an advantage, I think, of mentalism, particularly what you're talking about with bizarre types of things, in which that they have a real emotional hook that where you're not just stepping in and reading their mind, but they are actually feeling an emotion.
Correct. And what we did with this show was, as we created this patient and we gave the entire audience the experience of becoming that patient and going into the asylum and being stripped away of their identity. And about 45 minutes into a 90-minute show was the one magic effect. I deliberately looked for the biggest, brawniest guy in the room, and I invited him up on stage and we introduced a straitjacket. And at that point, we invited a spectator, my assistant, to come up, who was a deliberately hired, you know, this little teeny tiny girl that looked, you know, dark hair and very pale. And even though she was wearing just a contemporary gray plain dress, you would see her and you would see, you know, very easily someone in an asylum. You know, it would give you this feeling of someone who has been locked up for a long time. And this girl would walk on stage without saying a word, and then she would extend her arms very slowly, and we'd invite the man to start putting the straitjacket on her. And as this is happening, I'd explain to the audience that you're witnessing the compliant application of a straitjacket, that this girl is allowing this to happen. But for patients of the asylum, it would often be done by four different orderlies. It was not uncommon for these women to fight back, and in doing so, they would dislocate shoulders and break fingers. And if they were injured in the process, then too bad. That's just the way they were left. So we would have this girl restrained, and once she was all locked up in the straitjacket, she just moved over to a little crate at stage right and sat down. And then I'd continue telling my story. And on any given night, it would take about 5 minutes to watch, and I would deliberately watch the audience kind of look at her and then focus back on me, look at her, focus back on me. But after 5 minutes, nobody looked at her anymore. And we would continue the show. And the reveal at the end of the show was an image of Colney Hatch today would come up on this big screen. And I would explain that today, this once horrible asylum is now some of the most expensive property in London, that it's a collection of flats, and that Madonna has a flat there. And in the picture, you see this beautiful Gothic building with manicured lawns and topiary, and there's cars parked all around it, and there's not a BMW in sight. It's all Aston Martin and Rolls Royce. And, you know, it just screams money and luxury and a wonderful place. And I would tell the audience, you know, that this horrible place became this beautiful place, not out of, you know, anything other than a really public outcry. It was the families of all these women that spoke up. And that is what closed the asylums and changed all of these things. And without public advocacy, nothing would get done. And I would pause and I'd look at the audience, say, now, ladies and gentlemen, after every time we do this show, people ask us if everything I've told you for the last 90 minutes is true. How come I have never heard of this place, Colney Hatch? How come I've never heard of all these horrible things? How can all of these women have been forgotten? And I would leave that hang in the air for a few beats. And then I would look at the audience and say, ladies and gentlemen, I must ask you tonight, how many of you have forgotten the girl in the straitjacket that is sitting right in front of you? And as one, every night you would watch 300 heads turn. And the look of guilt that would hit these people's faces was profound, because they had all forgotten her.
And she was still wrapped in a straitjacket. She wasn't out yet.
Nope, right. Still sitting there right in front of them. And in that moment, we had a very emotional piece of music that would play. And this little tiny girl would stand up and physically just fight her way out of the straitjacket, and then throw it down and walk out without saying a word.
Wow.
And it was a really great piece to finish with. But as a magician, the first night we did it, it was overwhelming, because that's a very natural applause cue, you know? So here I am center stage. She walks out and I said, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. And I kind of take not quite a bow, but kind of in that position of like, this is where you clap now. And the theater was silent. Nobody clapped. Not a single.
They were all thinking.
People were thinking.
Embarrassed.
People were crying. And I just said, thank you. And I walked off the stage. And, as the audience came out that night, we had probably about 60% of the audience was women, and the number of horrible stories that I heard that night from many of these women who
abused,
you know, suddenly felt like they had an opportunity to say, these are the things that happened to me.
Wow.
Was amazing. We even had one night that we did the show where we were in the lobby for a good 5 minutes waiting, and nobody left the theater. And the stage manager comes back and says, excuse me, Mr. Sinclair, I don't know what to do. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, well, I've turned the lights up, I've turned the music off, and everybody's just sitting there talking about what they just experienced. Nobody left the theater. They just turned into like a spontaneous discussion group. It was really kind of, it was very powerful.
A big group therapy.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing.
Yeah. Wow. And that you could take a single magic trick, a straitjacket escape, you know, something that is generally presented by magicians as, look at what I can do. Mm-hmm. And by changing its presentation, it became this very emotional piece that, you know, 300 people a night could connect with.
And how long did you continue with that show?
We did the show for 6 months.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt. You started to say, what? Did that what?
Oh, well, the first night we did it and I saw the reaction of it, it made it very, very difficult for me to go back to a bar the next day and go pick a card, any card.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that card tricks aren't fun or entertaining. It's just that for me, they became very trivial. And dealing seconds and bottoms didn't really seem so important anymore to me.
This reminds me when I was talking with Noel Britton a few years ago on an episode, and he is a well-known comedian. Well, now he's the president of the Magic Circle, but he also has a thing in Bath in which it's called Bizarre Bath, and he does a walking tour. It's a bizarre kind of a thing. Anyhow, but he's a funny, very funny guy and a comedian. And I had called him, long story short, he's been involved with saving orphaned orangutans that are either abused by the mother orangutan or they're poached by poachers or, you know, and used for, I don't know, ashtrays or whatever. But he was just saying after spending time and trying to work with these orangutans, it's difficult to try and find humor in the world to come back to the UK and try to work a comedy club and writing new material when I'm not finding really anything funny. Because during these months that he's in there, it's like, how can you switch that off and then all of a sudden go from these horrific scenes that you're seeing of animal abuse to saying, okay, well, let's start laughing for a few minutes about something different. It's a difficult kind of thing. So I can imagine what you're talking about of trying to go back the next day after you've had something that had been so serious and heavy to saying, hey, pick a card. And
it's weird. Mm-hmm. It's also kind of this, you know, it was a good study in humanity in doing the show for the 6 month run that we did was, because we marketed it as a benefit for domestic violence shelters, whatever town we took the show to, whatever the show made, it went to the shelter. There was no profit to be had from it. It was really kind of a, let's just try to help somebody. And it was this positive thing. But what was devastating about it was that we would go on radio and television and do the media and the promotion. And because domestic violence is such a sensitive subject, mm-hmm. The outcome to the shows was minimal, where if we had taken the same show and built it and marketed it as a scary night at the asylum, we'd mm-hmm. have packed the house every night.
But they want to keep the truth in the closet, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. easier to not talk about it.
So are those things that you talk about now in the show that you have at the Stanley Hotel, or are those things you have developed or you touch? I assume you still touch on that, but maybe not to the extent. You did.
We don't touch on that as much, but it's more about there are these historic haunted places in the United States, the Queen mm-hmm. Mary, the Stanley, Waverly Hills, and they all have these amazing, you know, ghost hunters go there and go ghost hunting. And, mm-hmm. you know, you see on TV, you know, these interactions of like, I got pushed, I got scratched. And with the history of The Shining at the Stanley, I'm on property 5 days a week, and every day somebody asks me what room was the murder in, and then they're disappointed when you tell them that there isn't one. It was overwhelming to me that so many people who go to a place that's historically haunted go there looking for negative things. They look for murders and violence and suicide, and many of these iconic places have none of that history. That the history is actually pretty amazing. You know, the Stanley was a private hotel for the first 20 years. And if you stayed there, you were a Rockefeller or a Carnegie or a, you know,
mm-hmm.
There were two people. Yeah. I mean, it was very exclusive. You had to be privately invited to stay there. So what we try to convey in the show is that If you've come to visit a place that is reportedly haunted, it doesn't necessarily mean something bad has happened. And we try very hard to have people look at the place in a more positive way. And we try very hard every day to convey to people, like, look, this is a place where people fell in love, where people get married, where they have their honeymoon. And we don't really know what happens to us when we leave this world. We can have faith and belief in what may become of us. But even in that, there are questions of, did I do well enough to go to the good place or the bad place? And we all have our own interpretations and beliefs of what those things are.
Well, as far as finding the location, I know that it's difficult occasionally to try and find the right place, because some places that might have a haunted past want to keep that quiet. For an example, when we were looking for a place to do a seance here in Houston, there was a hotel that was turned into a condo that had a haunted past. And when we had approached them about doing something in a banquet room, they said, we don't want to have anything to do with that, because if the residents here have something go wrong with their water system or whatever it is, they're going to say it's because of the ghosts and we want our money back, basically. So we're trying to get away from that, as opposed to some that embrace it completely and saying, yes, please come and bring your equipment and see if you can find something or hear something too.
It's a very delicate kind of environment. Even the Stanley Hotel, the owner is very much invested in the history of the hotel. And he understands that people are going to go there for the paranormal and the haunted, but he does not really actively embrace it. You know, our show exists because it's a show, and the banner says illusionist.
How'd you approach him on that?
We approached the hotel a couple of times. And this is one thing I would encourage magicians out there that might listen to this, that are, you know, aspiring to do this full time and to make it their life. Be it bizarre or sleight of hand or whatever your personal style is that you'll approach a venue and go, hey, I got this great idea for a show. And they don't know you. You're a complete stranger to them. Right. So you represent a huge risk to their reputation, their business. And they also get approached by people with ideas every day. So you're going to get a lot of no's. People are going to close the door in your face. The first time I went to the Stanley, I took a tour and I was like, this place is amazing. I would love to do a show here. And I went up and talked to the tour guides afterwards and found out who the point of contact was. And I put together a very nice email and I sent it in. And the first response I got from the Stanley Hotel was a no, a very hard no, in fact. The person responded saying that, you know, this was someone who very much believed in the paranormal, and they sent me this nice email that said all paranormal activity that happens at the Stanley Hotel is legitimate. And if we had a magician on property that created paranormal activity, then it might affect people's beliefs. And I can respect that. The hard part I had with the email is the tagline is the second paragraph this woman wrote to me was, also, we asked the ghost if they'd be comfortable with such a thing, and they said no. And I just laughed. I lost my, excuse me, but I was like, are you seriously? The ghost said no, you know? Later I would find out that the woman who sent me the email wasn't a manager or a person of authority. I didn't know who I sent the request to, the wrong person. So somebody else was able to tell me, hey, you know, this is the actual manager. This is the person you want to talk to. But, I didn't get an initial response from them, and a couple of years went by, and then somebody that has a travel company for paranormal kind of events, you know, where they bring all the ghost hunters out and you get to meet them and hang out, and they have lectures, all of those kind of things. There's a company called Strange Escapes that's owned by Amy Bruni. She's the star of Kindred Spirits on the Travel Channel. When she's not on TV, she runs this travel company and she does these events all over the world, and they're extraordinary. Cause you get to go to really cool, amazing historic places, whether you believe in ghosts or not, it's an amazing weekend. You know, you at least get to go to like Gettysburg or the Lizzie Borden House or the Stanley Hotel at the time. So she hired me to do a show for her event. And, luckily one of the managers at the Stanley came into the room and watched the show. And at the end of the show, I got to meet him, talk to him for a bit. And I said, you know, I live an hour and a half away. I would love to bring the show down. And we made a business kind of risk. We made an offer to the Stanley of, look, we will come down and do the show one night at absolutely no cost. and you can sell tickets to the public. And whatever you make, you keep. But I wanted them to see the financial viability of the show and for them to actually make money.
A 90-minute show?
Did a 90-minute show.
It wasn't really a seance. It was actually a performance.
It is. It's a we kind of build the show as a theatrical seance, and we do that for a couple of reasons. It's truly not done in the dark. It's done on stage. Mm-hmm. It is a lot of storytelling. The intent is to give people the experience of things that if you went to a seance in the 1800s or 1900s, what kind of things did people experience? But also, what would it look like if we could truly conjure a spirit today? In this historic haunted place. And we do that by introducing guests of the hotel, people who were really there, who have true history to tell. And the guest ends up seeing strange things, but also leaving, having an experience of knowing, wow, that's what this place was like in 1909. And, mm-hmm. you know, so the other reason we bill it as a theatrical seance, though, on all the marketing is because I try to be very respectful of everyone's religious and personal beliefs. And if you sell it as a magic show and somebody that might be a Jehovah's Witness maybe comes into the room and they see a spirit board or, you know, tarot cards, that's not things that they can be around in their faith. Mm-hmm. The word seance itself can be scary for some people. And the truth of the matter is, if I put that on my poster and it says theatrical seance, that person is not going to accidentally buy a ticket. And for that
person, they know what they're getting into.
Absolutely. And when they see the word seance, then that tends to make sure that that person who might be offended by that kind of material never sets foot in a room. I'm not going to say it never happens. Occasionally it does. You know, we've had people make it into the room because they just didn't read. Mm-hmm. And they sit down and then they see tarot cards come out and they get up and walk out of the show. There was one night that, you know, as soon as we took Velvet off of a Ouija board, an entire family, the entire front row was bought out by a family of 12. Mm-hmm. And we take the Velvet off and the entire front row got up and walked out. And what was hysterical is I had a friend in the audience that night who's a performing magician. And he came up to me afterwards. He was like, dude, do you do that every night? And I was like, what? He was like, have like the front row leave, because that was amazing. And I was like, no, that just kind of sometimes happens. You know, it just is what it is. So,
and before we started recording, you had said there was an incident, I guess, not just once, but twice, in which the police had to take people away.
Yeah. Right now it's crazy times. You know, we consider ourselves very lucky to be able to work right now. There are so many people that are immensely talented and they're sitting on their couch playing Xbox. You know, like there's maybe six places in the United States right now where any kind of live theater can be presented. And it's humbling that we get to be one of them, but we have really strict conditions in order to do it. The Stanley Hotel is in this place in Colorado where the state gave them a variance to do live theater. The movie theaters are open, and they've done that because their numbers for COVID are very low. So for us, when we were asked to come back, we had to look at, like, first question was, if we're going to do a show, can we do it safely and responsibly? Because the last thing I want is someone to come to a show and get sick, or die. And that's the potential of this,
right,
that is out there right now. So we normally would seat 150 to 225 people a night for the show during the summer. We took the room and sat down with an epidemiologist and the Board of Health, and we basically created these 6-foot bubbles and capped the room at 50 people so that everyone has 6 feet in all directions all the way around them. Everybody must wear a mask for the whole 90 minutes of the show. As the performer, I wear a mask for the entire time because I'm not going to ask an audience member to do something I'm not willing to do. Mm-hmm. And added to that, this season, we started the show with a take on Luke Gervais' Something from Nothing. So when the audience walks into the room, I'm already on stage wearing a mask and blindfolded. And that's how the show starts. And I sit there like that for 45 minutes.
Wow.
So the reason I do it is to convey to the audience that, yes, your mask is uncomfortable, but I've been in here doing it longer than you. And I'm not taking mine off. And I, you know, so I'm not asking you to do something I'm not willing to do is the way we try to put it. But unfortunately, this summer we had two people that on two different nights that went online and bought tickets. And when you buy tickets, there's terms and conditions that really explain you have to wear a mask. You can't eat food. The mask has to stay over your nose and mouth. And we care about you and we want you to be safe. And we have had two people that read the conditions and then they arrived at the room and heard the rules at the door because we have to say them again. Mm-hmm. And one night it happened with me and one night it happened with JJ and David Minkin. Where the first 5 minutes of the show, you actually have to say the rules again. We're required by the county, but so it's abundantly clear of this is what the situation is. And unfortunately, I mean, I don't believe in the customer is always right kind of mentality. At that point, you're a guest in my theater. I am personally responsible for the safety of everyone there. And if you decide you're going to take your mask off, then just go. Just get out. You shouldn't have been in the theater to begin with. You know that, like, and we had two people this summer that wanted to make some kind of political statement where they came in and listened to all the rules, and then they took their mask off deliberately. And then when they were asked to leave the theater, they refused. They literally were like, I bought the tickets, I'm staying. So we had to call the police and go, look, we've asked these people to leave. They're putting people at risk. Please remove them. And I never in my life thought that I would have to witness that as a performer from the stage to watch armed men come into a room to remove people for such a trivial. You know what I mean? It's just,
it's not trivial.
You know, well, it's not that it's a trivial thing, but it's just out of to me, it's an act of kindness. Mm-hmm. And it is immensely, if I was a guest in your house, Scott, and when I showed up, you said, hey, in my house, we wear flip flops on the left foot and we hop everywhere. That's just what we do.
Right.
I'd be like, oh, cool. Scott's interesting, you know, but I guess I'm wearing a flip-flop on my left foot and I'm going to hop around his house
right.
because I'm your guest, you know.
Right.
And
if
those conditions aren't acceptable to me, then I would go like, yeah, I'm just going to leave you the casserole and I'll see you later, you know. So that's what's frustrating to me is this meanness, this kind of vitriol that seems to be out in the world. And I don't remember any other time in my life where it was there.
Right. I wanted to ask also about, you're talking about the Stanley Hotel and then other venues like the Queen Mary and the Winchester House and some other kinds of places. Each of them had their own set of circumstances, I'm sure, about how that you had approached them and the steps you had to go through in order to get them to accept this also. And I guess, did you use this as a blueprint from the Stanley Hotel in which you said, I'm going to offer you a free show and you can sell tickets and see how that it goes?
We were lucky. We were very lucky that once – this is, I think, a model with anything in any form of business is once a business becomes successful and it's generating revenue, other people want it. So with the Stanley we had two things happen at once that were serendipitous. One was that a television producer came in and saw the show and wanted to produce something which required us to be in California. At the same time that happened, the management company that was managing the Stanley also happened to manage the Queen Mary. So they had access to the books. So they had a very strong interest in getting a show out to the Queen Mary because at the Stanley, the show produces $500,000 a year in revenue. So it's not little money. It's big money for them. It's not in the magic world. It's not Vegas money, but outside of Vegas, it's pretty damn good. Mm-hmm. So simultaneously, I knew I had to be in LA for at least a year to do some filming. And at the same time, here's a ship with a whole lot of space and a whole lot of kind of haunted history.
Right.
And luckily, instead of us having to approach them, they approached us. And the Winchester Mystery House also had some representatives that came out and saw the show. They liked it, and they invited us out there. So the invitation helps. You know, getting the first door open is always a challenge, and it's hard. And a lot of magicians, I think, give up when they hear no. But you just got to kind of reshape and shuffle and figure it out.
Well, you know, that's true. Again, going back to another episode I had, there was a friend of mine who is a producer, writer, and director in Hollywood, and he was talking about all the times that you get these no responses. And his words were really encouraging to try to make sure that you continue to try until you finally get that yes. And it's important. I mean, he's the one who used to write the A-Team and Walker, Texas Ranger. I mean, he was had some successful things, but prior to that, he had some things that kind of flopped, like the Swamp Thing and some other kinds of shows and whatnot. But once also that you start getting some hits, then you can carry that into something else, similarly to what Dan Witkowski had produced. His company, MagicCon, had produced the Super Bowl. And so, I mean, he's got great credentials. Same thing here. If you got the Stanley, I mean, once that you kind of continue to work on whatever that you want to do, regardless of the no's you're going to be getting, which are inevitable, continue to work so you get the yes, then you can build on that into something else. So in this case, I assume with all these other places, you can't be in two or three or six places at the same time. So you have other magicians. And are they the same shows that you have scripted and given to them? Or, I mean, like in the case of JJ and David Minkin, that they apparently were working together, which was different than the kind of one-man show you're doing? Or
first off, Minkin and Jessica Jane are extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So we did a couple of things. When I went to L.A., initially we offered the Stanley to put in another show. And the owner and I have a really good relationship, and he kind of felt like, hey, just go do what you got to do, and we'll get you back eventually. But when 1 year turned into 2 years, he was like, look, we're missing a lot of revenue. What can we do? So initially, we had a very short order to put a show in about 2 weeks. So my first instinct was to hire somebody that I knew had a good show and that his show might be adaptable. We hired a guy named Felix Hopkins out of Denver because we needed somebody who was local.
I know Felix.
And he came up and he did a great show. But his show is stylistic and it's period, but he's a very good mentalist, and his show has more of a magic feel and a period magic feel to it. Mm-hmm. And the owner got really used to this very spooky seance show, that is dark, and the room is dark. And, so unfortunately the night that the owner saw Felix's show, it was too light and too happy, and just, the audience loved the show. People responded to the show great, but at the end of the day, the owner is our client.
It wasn't on brand.
And because it wasn't on brand, we were able to keep Felix for about 3 months. He did one contract season. And at the end of that, we had to figure things out, you know, and he's been doing a show for 40 years. And I'm not going to take a performer that's been doing a show for 40 years that I like and respect and go, hi, that thing that you do really well, stop doing that and do my show.
Yeah.
You know, because that's not an okay thing to say to another performer. The other side of it was at that point, we knew we needed an on-brand show. And luckily, there's another entertainer in the Denver area who performs under the name Clairvoyant, and she's extraordinary. She's a good mentalist. She's got great chops, and she's very adaptable in the sense that she was able to take all the things that she knew, and she had some talents that other magicians don't have. She's a classically trained pianist. You know, she can play piano, and to add music into a show is kind of a cool thing to be able to do. Mm-hmm. So, we hired Claire. We brought her out to LA, and luckily with Claire, we had more time. We had almost a month of headway, so we were literally able to fly her out to L.A. She stayed out there for a month with us on the Queen Mary, and we wrote her show from soup to nuts and made sure it was on brand and it had pieces of her. But it also it basically kind of took the show that I had been doing at the Stanley, and we stripped it down, changed the presentation, but then built the show around effects that we knew would work under that environment. And when she rolled out, she was able to present a brand new version of Illusions of the Past that told stories that I hadn't told before and was really focused on Flora Stanley, the proprietress of the hotel. And it had this personal connection because Flora Stanley played the piano. Hmm. So, you know, here's this amazingly talented female magician who's now doing the same thing. The downside was March showed up. And when March showed up, you know, COVID-19 happened, and we closed as soon as we heard that Disney was going to close and that this was a pandemic. We closed all of our shows. Mm-hmm. Immediately, at that point, there hadn't been a state mandate to do so. We just knew, you know, hey, if Disney is closing, this is a big deal. Right. That's the way we looked at it. And honestly, when we closed, we're like, it'll be a couple of months. That's what I think everybody thought, you sure. know. So we closed the Queen Mary. We closed the Stanley Hotel. And here we are 6 months later. And we're still living in this world. And unfortunately, the Queen Mary is probably not going to be reopened until 2021 at this point. It's a larger venue. It requires more personnel. But when the Stanley was able to be reopened, it put us in a really awkward situation because we would love to have Claire back. But the reality of it is, if I'm not working, I can't pay somebody else to work.
Sure.
So at that point, we'd grown to the extent that we had 7 employees in 2 different states. And there's only one show running now. And that show used to have a 225 ticket capacity. It now has 50. So for us, we're fortunate that we're able to perform. But the income change it's not little. I mean, it's enough for us to pay our bills now. You know, it's like going backwards 5 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we also had a construction project going on at the Stanley at the same time where a large full-time permanent theater is being built there. And that's going to require some tap dancing. So once 2021 comes around, we have 2 things that are opening up. One is that our theater on the Queen Mary, I can no longer be there full time because I have to be at the Stanley full time during the summer. And with filming and some other things that are going on, I'm like a one-armed juggler right now. So the theater on the Queen Mary is about to become a more of a variety venue, which will employ local magicians in the LA area, as well as, you know, a tarot reader and, you know, some burlesque and kind of, jazz performers.
Mm-hmm.
Because that theater is becoming a more of an immersive environment to where when you walk into that theater, it's 1936 and you're on the maiden voyage of the Queen Mary. And, you know, you experience live jazz and people are dressed in period costume. And it's, you know, the Queen Mary had a history of boatmen, of card cheats that used to travel on the ship and steal money.
Mm-hmm.
So there are room to put card workers in there that can do really good sleight of hand. And
what about the Winchester House? Was that one that was just a one-off, or is that a continuation also?
We continue with the Winchester Mystery House. It doesn't have any actual theater, so we perform in the Winchester Mystery House itself. And we go back there a couple of times a year. So we're very fortunate to have a contract with them.
But they're not ongoing shows like at the Stanley or the—
They're not. No, they're not. And it is not a place that would support it at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
The advantage of the Queen Mary and the Stanley is that they're hotels. So every day you get 300 brand new people that are looking for something to do. The Winchester doesn't have the residency potential. So people tend to visit the Winchester Mystery House and go through a tour and then they leave town and go to San Francisco and do the mm-hmm. next cool thing.
Right.
So the only way we're able to capture shows there is really through locals. And, you know, once they see the show, they've seen it. So we're able to capitalize on bringing a completely different show back, but we do that 2 to 3 times out of the year. And that allows us to recapture that market. So, so it's a place I really, truly love to go. It just doesn't have the potential at the moment to sustain, you know, a full-time show.
So as we start to wrap up over here, I was going to ask, where can people find out more information about Illusions of the Past and where they might get tickets or showtimes, et cetera, et cetera?
You can always find us at illusionsofthepast.com. That's our show website. And we always post up there.
P-A-S-S-E-D, not P-A-S-T.
Correct. Mm-hmm. People always ask about that. You know, some people catch the pun and some people don't, which I think is funny.
Mm.
You know, this is a podcast that's mostly listened to by magicians and people that are
right.
either, you know, practicing hobbyists or people that are aspiring full-time people.
Right.
And I think the big thing is that, you know, for people that do listen to this, if you're aspiring to do this as your profession and full-time, that the risk of it is immensely high. There is no parachute. You know, you are now your health plan provider. You are your, you know, your breadwinner. And I can't reinforce enough how much, you know, there's way more business in show business than there is show. And if you if you are lacking in the business side of things, it is something that could be financially devastating, and it can also make you hate the art. That being said, if you are dedicated and focused and you're disciplined and you're willing to take on all the business work, you never work a day in your life because you get to do what you love every single day. And it's extraordinary. So plan before you make the leap. But I'd encourage anybody who wants to do this for a living to definitely pursue it. But be aware it's not for everybody. And I've been surprised to learn a lot about the ethics of magic in the last couple of years. And I can't tell you how many times that since we've opened these theaters at the Stanley or the Queen Mary or the Winchester Mystery House, people hear that we're performing someplace, and then you get into these relationships with the venue. So every time a magician calls and tries to underbid you or, talk crap about you, it comes right back to you. You hear it. So it's always disappointing to me that, you know, it takes a lot of work and time and effort to get a venue to accept a show.
It's the same thing with a restaurant. Whenever that you're a restaurant magician and the magician comes in and sees that obviously they will hire a magician, they're thinking, well, let me come in. And and that goes back to what you were saying then, too, Aiden, in which that if you are a friend and you're working with management, it's not just an employer-employee type of relationship. This is something in which they share information with you. It's kind of a partnership thing because you're making money for them. They're not just paying you. You're helping them earn money, basically. So it is a friendly relationship, so therefore they can share that information with you whenever they say, I won't believe whatever this guy said. He just came in and wanted to bump you out. You know,
it's always surreal to me, and I get those calls about a half a dozen times a year. Mm-hmm. And at a point when you're making money for a venue, they know what your value is at that point. Mm-hmm. So it's surprising to me how many people are out there that are just like, oh, somebody else has already done that work and opened that door, so I can just walk right in. Mm-hmm. And they forget what the rewards are of kicking the door open to begin with. You know, like when you establish a venue yourself, it is hard, and there's lots of no's, but when you finally get to your yes and you get your theater set up and you're doing your show the way you want to do it, mm-hmm. there's nothing more rewarding than that because you did all the work. Yeah. You know, it becomes a home to you.
Right.
So,
well, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, and you started to wrap this up with a lot of great suggestions and advice. So what would be your phrase? What is it that's your philosophy of life that you live by?
I would say, don't quit. It's easy to quit. It's easy to give up. Mm-hmm. You know, I anything that you put your mind to do. You can accomplish it. But that being said, be honest with yourself. Look at what your talents and capabilities truly are, and kind of put your work where your talents lie. It's not a life that's meant for everybody. But I would encourage people to kind of find their way in it and to use the art, you know, to be artists and not to be, I don't know. Magic can sometimes become a conflict. I think a lot of us in the art are kind of awkward and we had weird lives, and this is something that we learn and we're like, hey, I can do this and I can do this really well. Mm-hmm. But it's the way you do it that I think matters. And when you learn that you can really touch people with the art and make people feel things, then that's way better than fooling them.
And you've certainly proven that in spades several times. So, obviously never give up, never quit. So, that sounds great.
I'm just immensely thankful to be accepted in the art. I'm immensely honored and humbled to get to meet other magicians and to spend time at the Magic Castle, and just, you know, this is a very special world that we get to experience. I try to remember that every day I get up, that, you know, we kind of get to play for a living, and that's awesome.
That's true. We are very fortunate. And I'm fortunate also to have an opportunity to get to spend some time with you and make a new friend here. So this has been great.
Thank you, Scott.
It's been wonderful.
Thank you very much for having me, and I hope you guys have a wonderful day.
And the website again, what is that called? It's Illusion.
We're at illusionsofthepast.com, spelled P-A-S-S-E-D.
There we go. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Aidan Sinclair, and this is Scotty out. Thank you, Aidan, for being our guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. We appreciate you sharing some personal stories of your history, as we also have explored some of the illusions of the past. So we appreciate you helping us. So this is going to put a cap on this year's Halloween episode. So I guess it's time to close the door on this spooky season. And we'll be joining you again next week with something in a completely different direction. For more information on who's going to be our guest each week, be sure to subscribe to our weekly pod letter. Well, I think it's about time for me to go and finish putting the last few nails in my coffin. Until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to be honest with yourself and put your work where your talents are. This is Scotty out.